Hello. Welcome to The Plot Thickens with me, Ellie Griffiths. You might know me as the author of the Dr. Ruth Galloway books and the Brighton Mysteries. This is a podcast that takes you behind the scenes of crime writing, from what it's really like to be a published author, to the intricacies of our research, and just how we think up those killer twists. Each episode, I'm welcoming an expert guest to lift the curtain on everything you want to know about the world of crime fiction. For those of you who've read my books, there'll be lots of behind-the-scenes details on my characters, setting and history. But if you haven't come to them yet, we'll make sure to flag up any spoilers and there'll still be plenty to enjoy. Hello. I'm very excited because I'm here in the studio with Ruth Galloway. Or rather, with the voice of Ruth. Jay McDowell has narrated almost all of the Ruth books, and people are always telling me that they're just in love with her calm, gently humorous voice. And having tried to read my books aloud during the pandemic, I'm very much in awe of her vocal talents. So it's great to have her here. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
It's lovely to have you because you know Ruth in the way that no one else does. So I'm really looking forward to chatting about that. But first of all, how did you get into voice acting?
So when I was 17, my mum actually had a boyfriend at the time who was an audiovisual engineer, and he was working at an art centre called South Hill Park. And he was working for a Dutch company who needed a young voice. And Ian said, Jane could do that. So I went over and I earned £80 cash for about 2 hours' work, which was brilliant when I was 17. And I loved it. And what I remember about it is that I made a mistake. I think the line was, we'll put the cases in the boot. And I said, we'll put the cash in the boot. And I was so embarrassed. And they just laughed and thought it was funny.
You turned it into a crime novel.
I turned it into a crime novel. I did. So that's how I got into it. And I thought, wow, this is good. I should look into this. And then I just started to write to people, made the obligatory tape under the blanket, sent it to agents, and now have a brilliant agent in Amsterdam. So all my work for them I do from my recording studio at home.
That's wonderful.
So that's how it happened.
And what does a good voice actor need, do you think? What qualities?
I think they need to bring the story to life. I mean, it depends what you're doing. If it's audiobooks, you obviously have to prepare very well, which means reading the book, picking up on any words that you can't pronounce, making sure you pronounce them correctly, researching all the accents, because I've heard stories of actors getting to page 300 and thinking, oh my God, that character's Welsh. Oops. So really good preparation. And I think just making it come off the page and engaging the listener with commercials, it's different because you're selling something. So again, you want to bring it to life, but you're also bound by time. So you have to fit the text into 10 seconds or 30 seconds or whatever. And for me, I think one of the things that helped me get into working for the BBC was that I'm fluent in another language. I speak Italian, as you know.
I do know.
And that was my sort of USP. And they wanted someone who could speak the language, pronounce the words, familiar with the culture. So that got me in the door because I thought, oh, I won't hear from them. But then I did.
That's wonderful. And Jane has actually recorded some of my first books written under my real name, Domenica De Rosa.
Indeed, I have. And I love them too.
Oh, it's wonderful. I have to say, I'm not obviously giving any names away, but the very first person who narrated one of my Domenica books, it started off The Italian Quarter by Domenica De Rosa. And I couldn't listen to any more because my actual name was pronounced
Domenica.
Wrong.
Domenica. Sunday. Domenica de Rosa.
Yes, and it's beautiful, beautiful pronunciation. So how did you first encounter Ruth? I was trying to remember myself when you and Ruth first met.
I first met Ruth when I did one of my very early books for BBC Audiobooks down in Bath, where I absolutely love going there. And the first book was The Crossing Places, of course. And I met this wonderful woman who in many, many ways I really identify with. She's not very like me physically. I think of her as very statuesque and tall and beautiful. And I was a dancer, so I'm small and slim and sort of quick. But in many other ways, we're very alike. And I just love her independence and her fierce intelligence and the fact that she is absolutely not bound by, you know, having to look beautiful. I think she is, in reality, she is very attractive. But she doesn't care about slopping around in clothes, and she loves Bruce Springsteen, and she loves Radio 4, like me. And she loves her cats. And I love all the stuff in the before she has Kate. And also with that, because she absolutely unexpectedly falls in love with her daughter, Kate. And that's what happened to me when I had Antonia. But in the early books, it's just funny about the cat substitutes and their baby substitutes. No, they're, you know, they're not baby substitutes. If I had a baby, it would be a cat substitute.
I've got to say, I do quite like that line myself. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask if you liked Ruth, but I think you can tell that you like Ruth from the way that you are her in the books.
Yeah, I do. I really love her. And her, just her absolute sort of healthy disregard for organized religion. Her parents, bless them, who are, and I love the born again Christians and, you know, burning in hell. And like you, I'm a Roman Catholic, but I'm a, you know, what I call a cafeteria Catholic. I take the bits I like and I leave the rest.
I love that. I sometimes say freelance Catholic.
I'm a freelance, like, yes.
Working from home.
I work from home. But I like her sort of healthy disregard for organized religion. But I do love all the Catholic stuff. So I found it just so moving with the priest, Father Hennessy, when Nelson goes to him when Ruth is pregnant, and he just says, and it always gets me, love is always a force for good, so don't worry, it'll be fine. In at the end of the last book, where it's the house at sea's end.
And Jane, you remember them better than I do.
Yeah,
so that's great. I'm so glad you like that. I have to say, Father Hennessy is, I was asked recently who was my favourite minor character, and I think it might be him.
I do, because I had a lovely, lovely priest, Father Sean Hegarty, and I just think of him as like Father Hennessy.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. Thank you. So how do you prepare for doing an audio version of a book? Because I have to say, I love getting your questions, because you're one of the first people to read it. And then you come back with these great questions like, should Ted be Bolton with just a tiny hint of Irish?
Well, because he's described as Irish Ted, yes, the archaeologist. But then you say he's not, but quite far through the book. So when I first read it, I thought, oh, he's Irish. But I don't make any decisions until I've read very carefully the whole book, and it's not a speed read. I read it very carefully and I make very detailed notes. So I have the pronunciations. So in the last book, there was Gaelic.
Yes.
Thank you.
Sorry about
and
that.
I had to get help for that. I remember the first time I recorded it, I asked Father Sean, and he helped because he speaks Gaelic.
I love that.
But this time, David researched it, David Roper at Heavy Entertainment, and he wrote it out for me phonetically so that it was correct. Because listeners are fussy and you have to get it right. So I have my pronunciations and then I write down all of the characters and then I make notes where they're from. And if it's an accent that I don't know, like Norfolk is tricky.
Yes, and you do it very well, I think.
Thank you. I have a friend from Norfolk and I phone her up, Adele, and we speak and I make notes and I take, it has to be understandable. It doesn't want to obviously be thick accent, but I make notes, maybe three or four particular things that make it recognisably from the place. So I had to learn Korean, English with a Korean accent, for example, or, you know, various American accents. And there's lots of Irish in the books,
yes,
but they're not all the same. And I have to also be careful to differentiate between Cathbad Carver, Father Hennessy, who's older, and Irish Ted, who comes from Bolton. He's not Irish, but he adopts an Irish accent, yes, sometimes for fun.
Yes, yes. So. It's so. And this is what I mean about you having it as a different angle on them all. And I do remember one of the books, I'm not going to say which one it is because it is a bit of a spoiler, but there is, somebody has to be American but not sound it. And I remember us having a conversation about this. And your solution is so clever because you wouldn't necessarily think she's American, but there's just that something about the vowel sounds.
Just a hint.
Yes.
Just so that you think, oh, okay.
And in retrospect, you think, oh, that's where she's from.
Yes.
So clever. And writers often don't think about that. I think when we're merrily writing, oh, so this person was from Irish. And
I mean, like with Tatiana, who was in the last book.
Yes.
Who Ruth worked with on the war graves in Bosnia, which I found profoundly moving as well, especially with what's happening in Palestine.
Of course, yes.
And she's described, she still has a Bosnian, a Serbian accent, but a hint of East Side America. Okay, right, we'll just...
Did I say that? Just, that's yes, very mean of so me.
Just a little bit of American, but mostly I made her Eastern European. So because that's how it felt.
Yes,
that she
I think
would be.
Definitely that's the vibe that she gives. It's an Eastern European vibe. Yes, of course, you're re-recording and this is House at Sea's End, isn't
yes,
it?
That's so right. Yes, and Tatiana comes back and stays with Ruth.
Yes, I found it very... I researched the work that forensic archaeologists did in Bosnia and it's very, very moving that the work that they did to sort of identify bodies there. So have you always been, Jane, have you always been good at accents? Have you always been a bit of a mimic? Where did this all come from?
I think I've got a very good ear. I'm musical. I play the piano and I sing. I wouldn't call myself a singer, but I can sing. So I've got that sort of good ear for picking up accents. And my daughter's the same. She's absolutely brilliant. And sometimes I think, you know, who am I living with? There's so many different characters that come out every day and people laugh at us because we'll go into,
It's a great, my kids, I have twins who are 25, are both very good mimics and good at accents. They're both musical. My son's a musician.
I mean, he's a pianist,
isn't
he?
Pianist,
I remember,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, and they're very, very good at accents and their Italian accent's very good as well. Whereas I think that does come from having that wonderful ear, doesn't it?
And I think it's just fun to, I mean, not in an unkind way to mimic people, but I remember when I was very young hearing a Scottish accent and mimicking it, my mum and my grandma telling me off and saying, no, that's very rude, but so.
Do you do the thing when you're with someone? Because when I first met my husband, Andy, who
I do it unconsciously.
Yes.
Yeah. And I oh my God, I'm speaking in their accent. And I have to apologise.
And it's sort of an empathy thing, isn't it? When I first met Andy, he was with his friend Charlie, who was Scottish. And I thought Andy was Scottish because he had this Scottish accent and clearly he wasn't.
Yeah, I do that. I pick up accents. And often I'll speak to people and I'll say, oh, where are you from? Do you mind? Because I'm so interested in people's accents and how they evolve and why they evolve, which has to do with weather and all sorts of things, apparently. I looked it up once.
Ooh.
And I say it's because I record audio books, and then of course we're away because people are always interested, and I try and identify where they're from.
It's a very wonderful skill, I think, and you are creating a character with just your voice. So how do you go about that?
I visualize the character, so I have a very clear image of Ruth, for example, and what she looks like and what her house is like. And I mean, I think she's a bit like me. I think she's quite untidy and she has a lot of books.
Definitely.
And a slightly chaotic kitchen table and the animals go everywhere on all the furniture. And I was heartbroken when she loses Sparky.
Yes, I'm so sorry, readers.
So I visualize what she looks like and how she walks. And I think we spoke about this before, but because I'm an actor as well as a voice actor, and one of the ways that you create a character is through using animals and creating an animal. So for me, Nelson, who is big and prowly, he's a Black Panther.
He would love that.
Yes.
So, I love that.
Yeah. So I have an image of...
What about Ruth? Can you...
Ruth is kind of a mixture of things. Ruth is... she's also like a big cat in a way. She's quiet. Mm. She's slow. She's not... quick in her movement. She's quite deliberate.
Yes.
And quite. So I think she's also a cat and she loves cats. But she's also kind of like a dog who loves to relax and flop on the sofa and. Yeah.
I love that. I know you love animals. You're a big advocate for animals.
Potty about animals, yes.
Yes, me too. Me too. And I think one of the things that my editor does, many things, I have the same editor for all the books, all another Jane Wood. One of the things she stops me doing is anthropomorphizing the animals too much. You know, I'll write down Flint was feeling bored and Jane will write in the margin, no, he's not.
He's a cat.
Yes. He's not bored. He's a cat. And she's
but
quite right.
I think
right.
they do feel bored.
I think they do.
Because our dogs, when they get bored, they're naughty.
Yes. Oh, you can see. And sometimes they go into the room and they sort of unsheathe their claws one at a time and just do the carpet just for fun, just to stop their boredom. So, yes, we know cats feel bored. But I think without Jane, I'd probably be way too sloppy about animals. So it's just as well, really, that she's there. What about Cathbad? Because you do a really good Cathbad.
Yeah.
Animal for Cathbad?
What did I have for Cathbad? I can't remember. I have a very clear image of him. He's a druid. He's a bit of a hippie. I think he's a sort of fantastical animal. I think I had a sort of invented animal, a mixture of things. I see him as tall, not big like Nelson. Nelson fills his space and he kind of, you know, when he speaks, people listen. He flattens them. Even his superiors are a little bit afraid of him, yes. I think. But Cathbad is more fluid. He's more like water and I think of him as a shapeshifter.
Wow.
Because he has different personas. He's the chemistry lab assistant, but he's also a druid and he's also mystical. And in one of the books, he's asked about that. Someone says to him, are you magic? Or and he says, no, I'm just in tune with nature. And I think he comes from his heart always. I love it when he and Judy get together.
Oh, I love that, Jane. Thank you very much. Yes, I think that probably is true. There's a sort of shape-shiftingness about him.
Because he always turns up when he's needed. And like when they have to cross the salt marsh and he knows the route, he knows the pebble walkway that no one else knows.
Yes, the crossing place.
The crossing place, exactly. The liminal place between. Yes. And I love the friendship that reluctantly develops, particularly on Nelson's side, between the two of them, because he grudgingly has to admit that he actually rather likes Cathbad, and he thinks he would have made a very good policeman as well, which I think he would have done.
There's something in them, even though they're opposites, that does sort of call to each other. And I've got some short stories coming out, which I'm sure you are going to read some of them, Jane, coming out in June. And one is from the point of view of Flint the cat.
Oh, yes.
And I've always wanted to write from Flint's point of view. And he rather resents Cathbad because he says that Cathbad can speak cat. Which he doesn't like being. Flint actually prefers humans to keep their distance. And so he's
like
slightly wary of Cathbad because he can communicate with him in this cat-like way.
Yeah. So. But he's never wrong. He knows that Nelson is a Scorpio.
Yes.
And that's the first time he thinks, oh, he was right about one thing, though. I am a Scorpio.
Yes. He did. I did make Nelson a Scorpio.
Yes.
He's got the same birthday as my brother-in-law, who's also from Blackpool, but I have to say otherwise they're not similar. So tell me about the process of recording. So I listened to a really interesting podcast that you did with Listening Books, which is a fantastic charity that makes audiobooks available to people who might not otherwise access the printed word. And you were talking about recording, I think you recorded The Locked Room, which is book 14 and is set in lockdown. You recorded that in lockdown, didn't you?
I did. So lockdown was awful and unexpected and just, you know, a complete curveball for everyone. But we were quite lucky in that we have now a purpose-built studio at home, which is, you know, professionally acoustically treated with a very smart Neumann mic and all the rest of it.
So you're not undercover. You said you're
not
under
blankets anymore.
Blanket, yes.
I mean, I still have to stop if the dogs bark, which they do if the postman comes by. But generally, it's pretty good. So I can work from home. So I go into my studio, shut the fire door, and then just get on with it.
And do you speak sort of with a producer sort of remotely?
Sometimes I'll just record and then bounce the files and send the WAV files via WeTransfer or whatever. Sometimes it's down the line, so I've got someone listening in. But mostly with books, I do it myself. So I have to be my own producer. And actually, I do prefer to come into a studio.
Really?
Because I'm kind of doing two jobs. I'm keeping an eye on what I'm doing and listening for extraneous noises. Whereas when I'm in a studio, all I have to think about is the narration and making sure that that's, you know, tip top.
How long does it take, or is it possible to say?
So let's say a 400-page book in a studio would probably take 3 days. I'm very fluent now because I've done a lot of books. So And if they're well written, as yours are, makes a difference. Because I have read some books that are not that well written, and you stumble more when they're not, you know, correctly written. And I'm a grammar Nazi as well, so I'll pick up on things like less people,
fewer people.
Stuff like that. but if they're well written, I'm pretty fluent and don't stumble much. So 2 or 3 days. And producers have got to know that. So I've noticed that my time that I'm booked in a studio has reduced to like 2 days.
Yes.
2 days
feels
per
book.
That
very
quick
to me.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is. But we get through them.
I remember when I was reading, love reading to my kids when they were little.
Yeah.
But some books were just easier to read, I think, because they were well written. Like,
yeah.
I loved reading The Wind in the Willows to them.
Yeah,
because
it's beautifully
it's
written.
Easy
and
to,
it flows.
To read. Yes,
that's
it flows.
The thing.
So apart from my books, what other books do you recommend? Do you loads? And do you have any particular favourites, like favourite genres?
I love thrillers, so obviously I love your books. I love the Italian books because I lived in Italy. When I was a dancer, I was working there and I toured all over the place.
Wow.
That's how I come to speak Italian. So I love any books that are set in Italy because it just reminds me, it feels like another spiritual home in a way. And I love the Italians, of course, and the La Dolce Vita and, you know, everything about Italy, the design, the people, so on. I've read some really cracking books recently. I read a wonderful book by an author called Rick Stroud called I Am Not Afraid of Looking Into the Rifles.
Wow.
Which is about the women of resistance of the First World War, the Belgian and French and English women, one of whom was Edith Cavell, who I always pronounce as Edith Cavell, but no, it's Edith Cavell.
Oh.
And we found that out from the family. And the title comes from one of the women, Gabrielle Petit, who was asked if she wanted a blindfold before she was shot by firing squad when she was arrested. And she said, no, I am not afraid of looking into the rifles. And she was 23, and that's what she said.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Oh, incredible book, really moving. Some of it was quite a hard read because it's quite graphic about what happens. And then I read a wonderful book called Snow Widows about the widows, as it were, of Captain Scott, Peter Scott, who made the second ill-fated expedition to the Antarctic on the Terra Nova, where they all died. And that's where, so I often say when I go out with the dogs, I may be sometime.
I do that too.
That's where
yes.
it comes from. It
yes,
was
Captain
Lauren.
Oates.
That's right.
Yes, yes.
And he knows he's going out into the snow to die because he knows yes. they're not going to survive. And that was, and the Snow Widows comes from the wives and the mothers and the girlfriends who are left behind. So it was just so interesting to learn about these real people and their lives, and Edwardian England, and Captain Scott's wife, who was an absolutely flighty beast. He was sleeping with everybody, and poor old Captain Scott was trying
goodness.
To get to, you know, the South Pole.
The things that you must learn, though, from doing these books. Because you
yeah.
must remember them. One way of remembering things, isn't it, is to say it aloud. So
yes.
Do you find it becomes very fixed
in
your head?
It becomes very fixed. I mean, I remember stuff that I learned at school, great chunks of Shakespeare. But
me too,
I said,
actually.
You know, the quality of mercy is not strained. Yes. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. Blah, blah, blah. And then I read, what else have I read? I work for a company in America. I read quite a lot of factual books for them about therapy, which is really interesting, emotionally focused individual therapy. But I also read a book about Lilith, who I'd heard of, but I didn't know much about. So Lilith is supposedly Adam, as in Adam and Eve's
yes.
first wife before Eve. So Eve represents purity, the angel in the house, the little woman at home doing as she's told, you know, white lilies, all the rest of it. But Lilith is the woman in all of us. And she appears in all cultures, in all stories. And she is the one who rebels against the patriarchy. Oh. So in Modern Woman, she would be the woman who wants to have the personal life, but also the career. And she's been demonized.
Gosh, how interesting.
History. I know, isn't it?
She I feel is Ruth the seductress. Would be definitely on the
she
side of Lilith.
She definitely has some Lilith.
Yes.
Yes, I'm definitely on the side of Lilith.
Yes.
But she's been absolutely demonized because, let's face it, history is written by men.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Yes.
How very interesting.
I know.
Jane, you've said a couple of times that you were a dancer, and I don't hope this isn't a stupid question, but does your dance ability affect your voice ability?
I think it does, and I think it's not a stupid question. It's a very good question, because even though you're sitting in a studio and sometimes standing, it's still quite physical. So I still, as I was saying about the animal exercises, I still have a sense of how these people move,
the physicality
yes. of them, and the tempo. People have a different tempo. So I'm quite quick in my movements, and I'm often rushing, whereas other people are slower. I think, for example, Ruth, who is, you know, she's taller than me and she's bigger than me, but she is more deliberate in her movements. And Nelson, definitely, whereas Cathbad Carver is the shapeshifter. He's tall, but he's not as solid as Nelson, for example. Nelson is slim, but he's just more sort of grounded, whereas
yes.
Cathbad is more fluid, and he can just appear when he's needed. So yes, that does come into it. He's more like Ariel.
Yes, that's so interesting. Yes, definitely. And I think Ruth says about Nelson at one point that he seemed too big for the room.
For the room, for her little cottage.
When she first meets him as well at the university, that he sort of...
Oh yes, for her office. Yes, he's too big for it.
He sort of seems too big and too serious for it in a way. So,
but gradually he reveals his other side, which is just lovely how that unfolds through the books.
That's lovely. It's lovely hearing you talk about it, Jane. Have you... what's it like when you don't, without giving specifics, because you must read about characters that aren't that sympathetic. What's it like being a character who's not sympathetic?
Well, I always try and find something about them that is sympathetic. So, for example, when we meet Jerry Whitcliffe.
Oh, yes.
Nelson's boss, and he really doesn't like him at all, who's from Norfolk. So again, that was interesting with the accent. So we decided that he would not be very Norfolk, but when he gets angry, I think you say he becomes more Norfolk.
I remember having that discussion about him, whether he should be RP, which means, doesn't it, received pronunciation?
Received pronunciation, yes. So, but we learn quite a lot about him and his family and the house at Sea's End with the German soldiers and everything and, you know, what's happened. So I think you have some sympathy for him. And I remember when I was doing Edward Spence, the builder, and the Spence family, I always thought were quite posh. And David said, no, he's a builder. I think he's got to be a little bit, you know, a bit Essex. So he just had a slightly off accent.
And he's slightly, slightly smarmy, isn't he?
He's slightly smarmy.
Yeah,
the Spence family.
He very much thinks he's Ruth's best friend, and she doesn't feel that either.
She doesn't feel that at all.
It is a funny thing, isn't it? Because Ruth's boss, Phil.
He's a not particularly sympathetic character.
He's not. He's one of the few, I think, characters that isn't, well, I hope one of the few that isn't sympathetic, but in I think it was The Lantern Men, I had a very short little bit from his point of view.
Yes.
And it's the bit where he stops off at the shops to get something for a dinner party
and he
sees some after eights and he thinks, I'll buy the after eights because that's what my mum used to buy.
Yeah.
And in that moment,
you feel for him.
Yes,
you
I do. Sort of
you
loved
feel
him.
Empathy, so did I. And also, I feel he's quite insecure, which is why he's always trying to kind of, you know, take precedence and elbow Ruth out of the way, because I think he has absolute deep respect for her because she's so clever and so knowledgeable and so absolutely, you know, committed to her work. And I think he's a bit more flighty. He's kind of impressed by the media and Time team. And
yes, he wants to be on TV.
But he wants to be on television.
Yes.
Whereas really she should be, because she is the one who is the real archaeologist.
Yes.
But so he has some redeming features.
I think he does. I'm glad you think that, Jane.
I do.
Definitely.
And then he gets together with Shona, doesn't he?
Yes. And again, Shona I have a bit of a soft spot for, even
Me
though
too.
She's not the best friend for Ruth ever.
No, she's not. And when it transpires that she had had a relationship with Eric, who, you know, of course, I love Eric. I've known men like Eric. He's an old hippie, but, you know, very attractive. So I loved all
Eric
that.
Eric is Ruth's first lecturer not her first lecturer. I think he's her advisor for her master's, but he appears in The Crossing Places and he's one of those rather charismatic figures that is also a little dangerous.
He's a little bit dangerous, and I can imagine how women would fall in love with someone like Eric. and then you have great sympathy for Magda, although Magda has her own.
Yes, Magda's his wife, who also comes into the book. So it's been lovely for me to write 15 books about Ruth, because it's meant that those tiny characters can come back.
Yes.
And what's that like for you as a voice actor?
I love it. And I mean, obviously, at some point we lose Eric, but it seemed kind of symbolic and right the way that he goes. And then he has, hope I'm not giving any.
Well, it's a slight spoiler, but I think it's fine. I think it's fine. It's the first book, let's say.
But he comes back in her head. So again, the Norwegian accent, I found a Norwegian friend to research English with a Norwegian accent, so that it was
very good.
Correct.
I think I said in my introduction that during lockdown, I tried to read some of The Crossing Places aloud on my Facebook page, and it just gave me new admiration for you, Jane, for all voice actors, because, you know, I'd forgotten that until halfway through reading him. And then I put in a very vague sort of Scandinavian lilt to his voice. But as you say, it's about being prepared and having that. And I'd written the book. You'd think I'd be prepared for him to be Norwegian. But it was a lot of fun to do. And reading aloud, I think you do have a very close relationship with your readers, and whenever I do events, Jane, there's always somebody who puts up their hand and says at the end, I love the audiobooks, I love Jane's voice.
Oh, so thank you. I'm so happy to hear that.
That must do you feel you have quite a close connection to
I do book? And a responsibility as well to really make the books, because they're wonderful books, to make them really come alive and make sure that, you know, the characters are right, that the voices are right, and that they live for people, because they really do. I feel I know these people. I want to meet them. I think they should be made into TV series, honestly, or books. They'd be fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
I've already thought who would play Nelson.
Who do you think?
Someone like Sean Bean, I think.
Do you love Sean Bean?
I do love Sean Bean. He has that kind of...
Particularly as sharp. Maybe it's something about the buttons.
Or maybe... Oh, God, what's the man's name? He was in... Jason Isaacs.
Oh, yes.
Maybe.
Because he's been Jackson Brodie, hasn't he? I love him as an actor.
Yes.
The books have been optioned for TV quite a few times, and they're optioned at the moment. And you know, I'd love to see them on TV. But a little bit of me is glad that I got to write 15 books about Ruth without... Without having those pictures, I guess.
I agree. And actually, I grew up without a television.
Really?
I love the radio, and I love Radio 4, like Ruth.
Me too.
I learn a lot from Radio 4. And it's just so comforting. but with radio plays and audiobooks, you create the pictures. And with television, it's kind of already decided for you. Someone has decided what this character looks like. But with just a voice, the reader creates their own version in their head.
And we're readers, aren't we? And the voices are better. The pictures are better in our heads.
Yeah,
and
I think so. So in a way, it's lovely that they've all been recorded and they haven't yet been on television.
I'm very happy, really, in retrospect, that I got to write 15 books, and the Ruth is the Ruth on my page and the Ruth in your voice. And I think for me that's perfect. So thank you so much, Jane, and thank you for coming in and for being my guest today.
Welcome. It's lovely to see you again.
It's great to see you. Thank you. To hear you. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to The Plot Thickens. In the next episode, I'll be talking to another expert guest, so don't forget to subscribe. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a rating or review, or better still, tell a friend about it. You can find me on Facebook or Twitter, X, at Ellie Griffiths. The Last Word, my new standalone novel, is available to read or listen now from all major retailers. And Ruth Galloway will return in a collection of new short stories called The Man in Black, coming this June. The Man in Black and Other Stories is available to pre-order now from all major retailers. This podcast is produced by Dan Jones at Carmelite Studios for Quercus Books. The executive producer is Katie Blott.